As most of you know, on past month's recordings, we've been including sections on common practice problems. We've had a section on statistics, as well as questions and answers. This month, I'd like to add to the format with a practice marketing section. It's going to replace our statistical analysis section for this month's recording. Having just completed our new patient generation seminar here in Phoenix, Whitehall's marketing materials are still fresh in my mind, so I'd like to talk about that. We're going to begin, though, by answering some recent questions that have come into the office. First, a doctor writes, "Greg, it seems that I've been trying to grow the practice for as long as I can remember. No matter what I do, it seems like I'm shoveling snow in a snowstorm. About the time I get one growth blockage fixed, another takes its place. If it's not staff turnover, it's a wave of patient cancellations. It just seems like it's never going to turn around. I've been working at this for more than 5 years in this location, and real growth stays just out of reach. Can you tell me something I don't already know to break out of this trap?" Well, first of all, doctor, that's a great question. And I'm sorry to hear about your frustration, and I hope you realize that the question you've stated here is really in the broadest terms. But the reason I want to go ahead and address the question, even though it's broadly stated, is that I hear this question so often, the shoveling snow in a snowstorm question. You could almost say that the answer to this question takes up where we left off last month in our audio program. See, if you recall, last month we talked about practices running on patient power instead of doctor power. For those of you who may not have heard that recording, the essence of the message was that when you don't give patients what they want, it's going to take more staff and doctor energy to keep the practice going. Eventually, not giving patients what they want has the effect of attaching a giant bungee cord to the practice. Struggle as you may, it'll only go so far. See, because the bungee stretches a little, it would always seem that you could go farther. The problem is that in the end, the energy requirement is simply too great. You're not going to go any farther. And it doesn't matter how motivated the doctor or staff happen to be. If your systems, policies, prices, and presentations are out of harmony with patients' expectation, you eventually grind to a halt from a growth standpoint. On this month's recording, I want to address some of the other problems that can cause a doctor to feel like that they're taking one step forward and two steps back. If you're feeling overwhelmed with all the things that have to be fixed, upgraded, or improved in order to build or maintain your practice, here's a few ideas that you can start right now to get you moving forward. And I might add, move forward with less effort and grief. Those of you who have had the experience of raising children, especially those of you who have raised several small children at the same time, already know that there comes a day when you have to get children to help with the basic household duties. The reason for this is that each child eventually adds to the stress and workload of the home simply by being there. It's no different in practice. Weak or unmotivated staff eventually create enough wind drag, or should I say management drag, that you, the doctor, are the only one doing any of the practice chores. Now, upon first hearing this, you may say that this doesn't apply to you. In this case, however, I'm not talking about staff taking on the basic household or practice chores. I'm talking about them taking on some of the higher functions we usually associate with the doctor. Here at Whitehall, we classify staff based on 6 levels of functionality. As we go through them, try to spot and type each one of your staff. All right, level 1, unable or unwilling to support practice systems. This might manifest in their consistently failing to use appropriate scripts with patients. A level 1 staff person's inadequacies tend to create constant stress and disruption in the clinic. This person also has a poor attitude and is difficult to work around. In other words, she's the worst on all fronts. She'll draw fire from existing staff for poor work and negative behavior. In short, she's your worst nightmare. All right, now the level 2 staff person. See, level 1 was they can't function and they can't get along. Level 2, this is a person that's not much different from level 1, except that she's pleasant and easy to work around. She's still inefficient, ineffective, and drags down the practice. But again, she's nice to work with. She's level 2. Hopefully you haven't spotted any level 1s or level 2s, but keep listening. Level 3, this person can and does support prescribed practice systems. He or she can and does follow scripts and outlines for efficient patient processing. This person also, however, has a poor attitude and is difficult to work around. But remember, the work is acceptable, it's just that she's not pleasant or easy to work with. All right, level 5. These are innovators. They'll create systems, not just use them. They'll create scripts or whatever's called for to make their end of the practice run smoothly as well as increase the productive capacity of the practice overall. This person is always pushing the edge of clinical delegation. She's trying to keep the doctor working at his or her highest best use at all times. This is a person who would likely succeed in running their own business. Do you have any of those in your clinic? They're pretty easy to spot. This is someone who's both willing and able to reduce the doctor's administrative and management responsibilities. You know, there's an old saying regarding staff and practices. It goes something like this. You can't run a $100,000 a month practice with a $30,000 a month staff, even though I've seen people try to do it. In answer to this doctor's questions about the one step forward and two steps back, I would cite the six-level staff grading system. You see, if you have too many level one or level two staff, the feeling of shoveling snow in a snowstorm is going to find you in practice, I promise. In short, you're going to be constantly looking for solutions to problems that can only be solved by improving the quality of your team. If you want to move your practice to the next level of production, you're going to have to make a commitment to have only staff who perform at the level four mark or above. If you've cleaned up your consumer offering as described on previous recordings, and you're still running on doctor power instead of patient and staff power, look no further. If you want to achieve superstar production status as described by Whitehall, you're going to need to have at least 50% of your team at the level 4 category. One more thing I'd say about the level 5 staff, these are incredible people, but they may not have mastered the ability yet to work well with others. Now, granted, they can do about everything. The problem is, at the level 5 category, these people are so capable, so motivated, they might be a bit offensive to other staff. See, this brings us to the next level, level 6. These staff are motivated, they're innovative, they're ready to take charge, and they can also perform this miracle of making other staff not be threatened by their ability and by the natural responsibility that's just going to gravitate to them because they're so capable. In other words, she is also a great leader. And this is where her special skills in working with others comes into play. She knows how to get her administrative assignments done without putting it in the faces of those she's charged with training and overseeing. Soon she becomes comfortable with training and overseeing, and others become comfortable with her doing it. These are staff that are incredibly bright. They're easy to work with, and they're driven to excellence. To my knowledge, there are about as many of these women as there are superstars in the Whitehall system in this country. That's right, with few exceptions, each of the practices it produces in the superstar range has at least one level 6 employee, and it makes the doctor's life so much easier. Terry in Dr. Corey Wagner's office, Ruth in Mitch Friedman's office, Regina in Dr. Tozer's office, Alice in Vince Monticello's office, Roy Smith has one of these people, Dr. David Neumeister, Gary Cameron, Roger Abbott, the list goes on. These superstar offices that you've heard on our superstar set and on our monthly tapes, they all have somebody like this, and these doctors have an almost idyllic existence because they found this person. So take a moment to assess your own team. How many level 1, level 2, level 3 employees are currently in the clinic? See, if you have more than one level 1 employee, you've likely gone as far as you're going to go. That's right. It starts and ends with team building. You see, the list of fears associated with staff upgrading, it ranges from wrongful discharge lawsuits to ending up with someone who's worse than you have now. I realize that there are a lot of fears associated with trying to upgrade a team. See, if this question applies to you, I suggest that you access some of our previous monthly tapes that talk about using the bullpen position to systematically upgrade your team. That's where you have an extra person who's brought in because she's better than other team members, or certainly better than some of the weaker ones, that has you thinking along these lines. See, I didn't say it was going to be easy. I just said that it has to be done, and that your life's going to be so much better in the long run for having done so. All right, next question. This apparently comes from a doctor who's recently been to one of our training camps or marketing seminars. He writes, "Greg, I know you're big on the referral practice, but I have noticed that some of your superstar clinics do advertise. Do they have to advertise? I guess what I'm asking is there ever a valid reason to spend money on advertising when you can get referrals?" Good question. You're absolutely right. We are big on referrals, and yes, many of our superstars do spend money on advertising. There are also superstar practices that are entirely referral-driven. There's some that are a combination. I want to cover now some of the finer points related to the decision to venture into paid advertising. In general, we say that advertising is for doctors who find themselves with excess productive capacity and want to jumpstart the practice. The excess capacity designation here usually applies, but isn't limited to, doctors who have recently moved into a larger facility and those who have taken on an associate doctor. I realize that this also could land on the doctor who's been forced to pick up a full-time hygienist in order to fill 1 or 2 days of additional hygiene demand. We usually only recommend that doctors advertise until they're able to replace their marketing patients with referral patients. I'm going to explain the reason that some of our superstar practices have chosen to continue to advertise in spite of the fact that they probably could fill their spaces with referrals. All right, let's go through them. Number one, this is the one that I already mentioned. They've moved to a larger space. They need help temporarily boosting the new patient flow. Number two, they found that they can secure patients through marketing at an unusually low cost. Number three, they're trying to position themselves in the community in such a way as to give themselves a competitive advantage and thus reduce their vulnerability to increased competition in the future. This is common with doctors in smaller towns where they really want to secure their position before they get flooded with a lot of other doctors. See, in small towns, you can feel the addition of each doctor to the community. It really affects you. You know, there's a saying that, you know, we really don't compete with each other, but we really do. All right, number four, they found that their personal referral power doesn't extend to their associate doctor. Marketing, in this case, only makes sense if the doctor has access to the inexpensive marketing patients that we described earlier. And number five, they've experienced a practice disruption, possibly from managed care or some external source, or internal, a self-inflicted wound. They've been overselling, or they've had high prices or rude staff and so forth. If one of these five that I've just covered here applies to you, then you're a legitimate candidate to spend money on paid advertising. Now, just because you've decided to pay for some marketing doesn't mean you're going to experience cost-effective advertising. We have a saying here at Whitehall that most advertising is an expensive attempt to launch patients over the top of the barriers we've placed in front of our practices. I'd like to take a moment to discuss some of the things that we've learned and observed about successful marketing in our 25 years of practice consulting. According to our database, I've personally consulted with over 4,000 doctors since 1991 when our current computer system was installed. And I'm sure there was many more that preceded our current computer system. When a doctor tells me that he or she's getting an outstanding response to a given ad, I ask them to mail or fax it to the office so we can analyze it. We then take the ad and compare it to many other ads in our collection that have worked well, and we look for similarities. Then, with the permission of the author, we make these ads available to non-competing practices that knowingly use them on an experimental basis. Now, we have a practice who uses ads on an experimental basis. We make sure it's a practice that is well-managed, where the front desk isn't going to sabotage the marketing. Let me share with you some of the things we've learned about winning ads, whether it's mailers, newspaper inserts, or the homepage of your website. Now, I want to warn you that your local ad representative or media buyer for the newspaper or the television or radio may not agree with this. These are the results of 25 years of collecting and analyzing marketing pieces, and we've distilled it down into what we call the ad scoring grid. We then assign values to the various ad components that can total up to no more than 60 points. The highest value we assign to any one component is 5 points. For example, placement, that's where the ad appears. Also size, eye appeal, the offer, which is the heart of the ad, benefit-driven headlines, ad depth, these are all worth 5 points. Now, payment barrier removal, before and after photos, we give those 4 points, as we do implied testimonials. Implied testimonials are photos of people in your ad that could actually pass for people, maybe even your own patients, as opposed to genetically perfect professional models that obviously are not your patients. Just having these components represented doesn't mean that you're going to earn the full 4 or 5 points. See, it's also a factor of how well developed each of these concepts are. For example, you might only get 3 out of 5 possible for placement, or 2 out of 4 possible for payment barrier removal. Although we allow 3 points maximum for an internet coupon tie-in, you may only be awarded 1 point by us because the type is so small that you can't read it, or the internet offer isn't prominent. I think you're beginning to get the idea here. We're not trying to teach you on this recording everything you'd ever want to know about creating an ad, but we want you to see that it's a little bit more challenging than people want to think. One of my favorites is add depth. This is a five-pointer and tends to be a problem with even the most costly ads. Ad depth has to do with what we call platitudes, the presence or absence of platitudes. First, let me give you a definition of that word. A platitude is a pointless or unoriginal or empty comment or statement made as though it were significant or helpful. You want an example of platitude advertising? Look at your own Yellow Page ad. If it's filled with words like caring, convenient, comfortable, safe, state-of-the-art, modern, affordable, these should trigger what we call the I should hope so response. When you say caring, wouldn't somebody say, well, I should hope so? If your ad says modern or affordable, again, doesn't that trigger that response, that well, I should hope so response? You see, if you use these, you're a platitude advertiser. And I worry because so many doctors, that's the whole point of their ads. There's no offer. There's nothing else really driving it except the platitudes. Platitudes only kill an ad if you stop there. It's okay to say those things, but then you have to have some sort of addition to that where you go in and explain what safe means or state of the art or affordable. If you're not substantiating each one of these, you're a platitude advertiser. See, we say that you have to go deeper. This is why we call it ad depth. If you don't go deep, you've just indulged in platitude advertising, and as you can guess, it's a complete waste of time and money. So instead of saying affordable, you might say 12 months, same as cash, or we accept Visa, MasterCard, or make financial arrangements. Instead of saying convenient, you might instead say emergency seen the same day, or list your hours. The list could go on. I know some of you are thinking that a professional ad agency wouldn't platitude your ads. If you're thinking this, you're wrong. Many of the ad agencies simply cut and paste platitude-rich copy from specially designed websites that they have access to. They know that this kind of copy isn't going to be contested by state boards because it literally says nothing that would induce someone to respond to the ad. You'll be told that the failing ads will eventually brand your practice, or that given enough time, you'll see a great return on investment. I mention this because you could have listened to my list of rationale to advertise and found that you qualified. Maybe you do have excess capacity and want to jumpstart your practice. That doesn't mean that your first attempts at marketing are going to be cost effective. We found that the way your front desk is handled is every bit as important as your ad scoring. What good does it do to have a high scoring ad if your front desk doesn't know how to get these marginal patients through the front door? And unfortunately, that's what even the best ads produce, is a fairly marginal patient. In far too many practices, we've been able to correct failing ad campaigns, not by changing the ad, but by changing the person at the front desk or how that person handles the phone. This is one reason that you should actually like advertising. I know you didn't think there was one, right? Well, there is one. Let me show you the benefit. Let me tell you why I can see advertising as having value beyond just the patients it brings through the door. A friend of mine, Greg Jack, also a practice consultant, told me about several of his clients who sent out mailers only to find out later that the mailers never went out. In one case, I guess a postal worker was dumping them in a dumpster somewhere. In another case, there was just a mix-up and the mailers weren't delivered. In both cases, the practice increased right after the time the doctor thought the mailers were being dropped. Different explanations were offered. Some thought that cosmic forces were released from the human mind once the person thought the mailers were sent, the checks were written, a state of expectation existed in the human brain, and that was what was bringing patients by reaching out through the ether into the cosmos, bringing patients through these, you know, mystical forces into the practice. You know what we later found out? It wasn't the mystical forces at all. It was simply that these doctors realized that they were about to spend a lot of money on marketing and made changes in the practice. When we see a doctor about to advertise, they're going to send some mailers, for example. They'll call me right before they drop and say, Greg, don't send those mailers. Stop now. And I'll say, why? They say, well, I just realized the person at the front desk is talking into the wrong end of the receiver. In other words, they got the wrong person at the front desk. And they finally saw it and are ready to make a change, you know, related to it, because they're about to spend $4,000, $5,000, $6,000 a month in advertising. All of a sudden they get serious. From that standpoint, I like advertising. It makes doctors get very focused and serious about their practice. See, we could never charge somebody $6,000 a month for consulting, but if we did, it would certainly get them, you know, to wake up and say, my gosh, I'm paying all this money. I better do what these people tell me. Advertising, however, does have that result. So we do see that as a positive. I hope most of you were able to listen to the interview we did with Jay Geyer of the Scheduling Institute. We released that on CD a few months ago. On that recording, Jay outlined a plan that he guaranteed would add 9 new patients to every practice that was listening, and that's the minimum. The more patients you're seeing, he says, the more you'll get by making these changes. He talked about the dual alternative close and how to transition a patient so the receptionist can gain control of the phone call. Like the ad scoring grid, we also use a scoring system that is a 40-point scoring system for the front desk of the would-be advertiser. We call it the intake readiness score. It measures 7 key factors that determine if a practice front desk is ready for the special challenge brought on by advertising patients. When I say special challenge, I'm talking about the fact that these people tend to shop hard for both price and convenience. See, when a front desk has grown fat and lazy from feeding on strong referrals, there's a tendency for these out-of-shape staff to turn up their noses at these marketing patients. These challenges that I'm talking about center around the fact that the calls generated by advertising don't really represent new patients at all. They are technically not new patients. These calls represent leads. That's right, even the best practice marketing campaigns only generate leads for your receptionist, who then has to turn them into real patients with her skills and training.